This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education, by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Just about 1 year ago, the Southern California-inspired activewear brand Vuori got a $400 million investment from SoftBank, giving the company at that time a $4 billion valuation. That brand founded in 2015 by Joe Kudla.
We got Joe Kudla joining us now, founder and CEO of Vuori, joining us on the phone from New York City, trading one coast for the other coast. Joe, good to have you with us this afternoon. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much. It's great to be here in New York.
Hey, well, thanks so much for joining us on this. So I want to talk about the company, but before we get to the company, I want to talk a little bit about the macroeconomic environment and get an understanding from you about how the consumer is faring around the world right now, because you guys are in expansion mode, which is definitely not the same thing as other companies that are out there right now that are pulling back a little bit.
Absolutely. You know, it's an interesting time. There is, without question, we are dealing with complicated macroeconomic issues on a global scale. But we do feel there's a bifurcation between, you know, best-in-class brands that are leaders in their categories, that are innovating, and folks that are maybe call it middle of the pack, more legacy mass market brands that are seeing, you know, growth really slow as a result of this inflationary environment that we're in. You know, we feel very fortunate to be, you know, experiencing dynamic growth this year. I feel our customer, our relationship with our customer has never been stronger. We're excited about Q4 and holiday. When we look towards 2023, we are being optimistic, but cautiously optimistic. We are planning for another year of dynamic growth. We are going to continue expanding our fleet of retail stores, but we're not trying to swing for the fences. We want to lock in a number that we're really content with, not overinvest in the business, and be responsible with our growth, because there are some macro factors that we're watching very closely, and we just don't know how things will go.
No. And, you know, it's interesting, too. I think at the time about a year ago of that SoftBank investment, which was just about a year ago, it was reported that you plan to open, Joe, more than 100 stores in the U.S. over 5 years. So as you look at those macro concerns, has that number been reduced or that plan, that forecast been changed?
You know, it hasn't actually. Okay. You know, the performance of our stores today has never been stronger. We're still very bullish on our vertical retail expansion. You know, four-wall contribution, payback, still best in class. And, you know, we're in a unique position because, you know, relative to the size of the market, Vuori is still very much early stage. You know, we're in our seventh year of selling in market. And there's a lot of opportunity to gain market share as we grow into the years to come. So while we might be in a more challenged macro environment, I think that will be counterbalanced by the growth and taking market share from some of the other more established players.
So talk to us about growth metrics. We're Bloomberg. We're nerdy. We love all these numbers. So talk to us about top and bottom line growth. Give us an idea. Same store sales growth. What have you guys been seeing?
Yeah, I mean, this year we're seeing, you know, the business is going to grow north of 70%, you know, between 70 and 80% top line at a pretty sizable scale. It's a number that we're very proud of. You know, our same store sales are still comping very strong over prior years, demonstrating, you know, that, you know, it's still very much early in our awareness curve. People are experiencing the brand. We're converting them into loyalists. They're shopping with us for years to come while acquiring more new customers. So we see really great year-over-year growth in our existing fleet. And then, you know, as we expand the network across the country, you know, we're leveraging e-commerce data so we can be really intelligent about where we go. And we tend to open strong. And I think that that trend is really accelerating as the brand builds more and more awareness.
Joe, how are you doing with inventory right now? We saw inventory challenges, of course, from Nike just in the last couple of weeks, not to mention, you know, companies that we can't necessarily compare you to, like Target, for example. How are you managing inventory?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, we have definitely seen impacts from this complicated supply chain environment. Although we are seeing it begin to normalize, especially on the logistics side of the supply chain, you know, getting your product in containers, getting it on boats and delivering on time, that has become much more normalized. The cost of a container, you know, from Asia to the West Coast of the United States, you know, pre-pandemic was, you know, call it $2,500 to $3,000. It went up as high as $18,000, now back to pre-pandemic levels or materially close to pre-pandemic levels. So the logistics aspects of supply chain have normalized, where we're still seeing a lot of challenges in the ability to source raw materials and get them delivered to your factory partners on time. So what happened to the larger marketplaces, you know, your spring deliveries delivered late, that created promotion as we transitioned from spring and summer into fall. And then you saw the same thing happen, you know, and it was a double whammy with the deliveries of fall being material delayed for a lot of our peers. And that's putting a lot of pressure on inventory levels. That's why a lot of folks anticipate highly promotional holiday coming up. Vuori, while we're not immune to these challenges, we've stayed very close to our supply chain. We've dealt with delays, but nothing that's been catastrophic. And we've been able to maintain our full price business, which has been a goal of ours since we launched in the spring of 2015. And we don't anticipate an overly promotional holiday.
Joe, you probably know better than anybody else the competition that's out there, whether it's, you know, those giant brands, including Nike, you've got Lululemon, you've got Under Armour. I mean, it's a super competitive market that could be on track for some slowing growth because, you know, what we're seeing is people are going back to the office. I've stopped wearing my yoga pants during work. You know, I'm back wearing, you know, what I would call grown-up clothes in a big way. So tell us, you know, what's the competitive advantage that gives you the optimism that you can continue on your growth trajectory?
Yeah, I think
and compete with those guys. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great point, you know, and it's interesting. When we launched the brand, we were facing this competition and we saw nothing but open space. And I think it's due to our product positioning, our brand positioning, the ethos of the brand, which is built to move in style for life. And it all comes down to building product that will support you in a workout, but it'll transition and work across multiple aspects of your life. And so we prioritize fabrications that have performance at their core, but they're incredibly soft. We design all of our products with a more modern athletic fit that works across multiple aspects of your life. And we design our product with an aesthetic, a color story that is sophisticated, that doesn't identify you as somebody going to the gym or going to compete in a sport, but it just, again, works across multiple aspects of your life. That was always the premise of the brand. And we applied it first and foremost to activewear, a product that you would move and sweat in. But the brand has really evolved. And when you look at our assortment and where we're growing, it's evolved from core fitness into outdoor, which is rooted in outerwear. Yeah. And the fastest growing segment of our brand is travel commute, which is taking the lessons, those technical fabrications and constructions that we applied to activewear and applying it to everyday sportswear. And that's one of the fastest growing segments of our collection. And those are the products that you're wearing to the office, you're wearing to travel, you're wearing on the golf course. And so I think our vision to build a more well-rounded collection that speaks to multiple aspects of your life is really benefiting us as you see the preferences of the consumer change.
Joe, there are a couple different directions that it seems like the company could go at this point in terms of trajectory. One of them is the Lululemon route, where you go public. Another one, and forgive me, but this has happened before. I think of a company like Outdoor Voices, which, you know, 5 years ago was the talk of the town. And has gone through several CEO transitions and a New York Times profile that essentially said that it imploded after raising about $50 million in funding. How do you avoid the fate of a company like Outdoor Voices?
It all comes down to your people, incredible leadership, alignment of your people, but hire talented people that are much better than yourself. That's been our ethos from day one, is building an incredible, incredible team that can see around those corners, you know, and prioritizing making incredible product. You know, we are maniacal about our products, our level of service. You know, the NPS scores in our stores are off the charts. And I think that's the most important thing. You know, it's a hard comparison. You look at a brand like Outdoor Voices and Vuori. You know, I wasn't great at raising capital in the early days, admittedly. I didn't have a background building an apparel business. And so the little capital that I did get, I had to make it stretch a long way. And so we prioritized, you know, the basics of business, the fundamentals of, you know, acquiring customers profitably from day one. And we built a business that was profitable from early stage, and we never had to sacrifice that profitability for growth over the years. And I think that's why Vuori received, you know, one of the highest private market apparel valuations ever, is because we've been able to demonstrate a commitment to growth, doing it profitably, and also responsibly with our commitment to ESG and making decisions that prioritize the planet as we're building.
Which is an important part increasingly for consumers. We know that they look at what a company stands for, their impact on the environment. Hey, Joe, just before we wrap up, so what's the end game here? Is it ultimately to go public at some point?
I think that could be a viable outcome. Right now, we're very heads down building the business. We're having a lot of fun. I'm a young man. I've got a lot of energy for the business. We've got big plans for growth, both here in the U.S. as well as abroad. And so today, that's what we're focused on. But, you know, we want to optimize the business and provide the best return for our shareholders. A public offering could be a viable option down the road.
All right. We're going to leave it on that note. Great stuff, Joe, and stay in touch so that we can, you know, hear more as you guys continue to grow the business here in the U.S. and certainly outside.
They're based in Encinitas, California, which is like the best place in the world. Okay.
Somebody
from Southern California, like Encinitas is great.
I know. You're kind of talking your book there, Tim Stenovic. Yeah. All right, Joe Kudla. Thank you so much. Founder and CEO of Vuori, joining us on the phone in New York City.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive. When bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring. When you have the right foundation, it starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, as we mentioned earlier, you know, what's past is prologue, which gets us to a story in the upcoming issue of Bloomberg Business Week. It'll be a new double issue out later this week. It's a story about Paul Volcker's inflation fight and how it hints at what lies ahead for the current Fed chief, Jay Powell.
Yeah, the Fed had to inflict a lot of pain in the 80s to convince markets it was serious. We've got just a fantastic guest with us this afternoon. Christine Harper is executive editor of Finance and Investing at Bloomberg Editorial. She joins us live in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. She's also, along with Paul Volcker, the co-author of Keeping At It, The Quest for Sound Money and Good Government. It's Paul Volcker's memoir. So, Christine, you spent a lot of time with the late former chairman of the Federal Reserve. I just want to start with that as some context here. Give us an idea of, you know, how he would, in your interpretation, look at the inflation fight that Jay Powell is doing today.
Well, I can tell you when he was writing his memoir back in 2017, 2018, nobody was paying attention to inflation. In fact, if they were at all, it was in an effort to get more inflation, right? So he was quite concerned that people were underestimating the risks. And so part of the mission of the book was to remind people of how important the central bank's role is in keeping inflation down and maintaining that credibility that he fought so hard to maintain. I mean, he had been involved in getting the dollar off the gold standard. And after that, the dollar was not, it was not connected to any actual value. And so when inflation took root, he had to, you know, drive interest rates up to unprecedented levels, cause all kinds of pain for people, for financial institutions. And the result was there was more credibility in the dollar. It, some people talked about it went on the Volcker standard from the gold standard. But, you know, that's something you can't squander because he fought so hard. So it's kind of like having gone to war to fight, you know, to win a battle and then discover that your future, you know, commanders are allowing you to give up the territory again. So he would have been very upset that inflation was allowed to get to where it was.
We're talking with Christine Harper. And as we mentioned, this is in the upcoming new double issue of Bloomberg Businessweek out later this week. Also with us is the editor of Bloomberg Businessweek, Joel Weber.
Christine, thank you for those remarks. Also, just wanted to ask, you know, and you might have to extrapolate here a little bit, but you got to know Mr. Volcker very well. I'm curious what you think, if anything, Powell might have learned from him, and if not him directly, then the book.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, as you and I have discussed, I mean, one of the things that's so interesting is how often Fed Chairman Powell invokes not only, you know, Volcker himself, who he says he's a great admirer of, but the book. I mean, he talks about everybody should read it, and he has used this phrase "keep at it," which people see as a echo of the title "Keeping at It."
Let's say that title one more time.
Keeping at it. And you know, the thing that I think Powell sees. And I mean, one thing that Volcker made clear was when I was speaking to him was how much he supported Powell as Fed chairman, because he liked the fact that Powell had this, similar to Volcker, had this experience of having worked in the in a private financial institution. In Volcker's case, it was Chase. In Powell's case, it's Carlyle and other places. And also working at the Treasury Department. So understanding markets, understanding the government is really important to being practical in the job and not just being an academic theorist. So I think Powell shares that sort of recognition that you have to win credibility from the markets, from the government, all these sides, and be practical in your approach and not just, you know, not just trust all the economists around you.
Christine, how tough was it for Volcker to hike rates? Like, what were some of the conversations that you all had about that, which was going against what everybody wanted, but it was necessary in order to right the situation?
Well, to that point, I mean, he said that when he came into the role, it was clear. I mean, the reason he was brought in really was to do something about inflation that his predecessors hadn't really succeeded in bringing down. Even so, at that point, the economists at the Fed were forecasting a recession. So he had to sort of ignore that and just say, we're going to raise rates. There was a split on the Federal Reserve Board on the second time they voted. And so the markets didn't believe there would be any stronger action. They thought the Fed was going to lose their spine. And so he turned to this monetarist approach of just targeting the money supply. And that essentially told people, we're tying our hands and we're going to let interest rates go where they have to go. And they went up to like
20%. Yeah. That's pretty remarkable.
You know, there's a name in here that I did not expect to see that I wanted to ask about. Larry Kudlow, who was quoted by the Associated Press at the time. And he was at Bear Stearns then. What did Mr. Kudlow have to say?
Well, I mean, it was funny looking back at the clips, because when Paul Volcker was telling me about this 4-3 vote and nobody believed it, and he didn't understand really why nobody believed it, because he knew the people who were supporting him would keep supporting him, but the markets didn't. So, and, you know, I did some research and found these comments that were made in the press at the time, including from then Bear Stearns economist Larry Kudlow, saying that essentially the fact that the vote had split on the FOMC showed that there would be a very timid approach going forward. The markets just didn't see the Fed being able to stick to their guns.
Okay, so I got to ask a question, because this book almost had a different title.
Oh, yes.
And we got to talk about that, because it's just this little Easter egg. Can you talk to us about the parrot?
Sure, of course. As I mentioned earlier, when we started working on the book, you know, nobody was really paying attention to some of the central parts of Paul Volcker's legacy, including inflation. And so he was feeling a little, I think, overlooked. And so he opened the book with this very funny joke about a parrot, a wise parrot who's known as the chairman. And I encourage people to look at the book, because it's a very funny little story. But he went so far as saying he wanted to title the book "The Wise Old Parrot Speaks." Now, the marketing department and I all agreed that was not a great title for this book. So we spent weeks trying to offer him other ideas, all of which he rejected. He hated all the pompous kind of, you know, pretentious titles that a lot of other economists and people use on their books. So we were really going back and forth. It was one of the most difficult things of working with him, because he was so stubborn on this. And so finally, one day, I was going through this long list of titles I'd come up with. You know, I found a phrase from the Fed minutes at that time, sustained commitment. And he looked, and he stopped, and he said, "Keeping at it." And it was great, because that really was him. You know, he believed in speaking plainly. And, you know, so he took the kind of jargony phrase and translated it. But I do think it would be funny if Powell was having to deal with the wise parrot? Old parrot.
Yeah. It just goes to show everyone needs a really good editor. Okay, that's what it comes down to.
To save you from yourself.
Right, to save you from
Paul,
yourself.
Even Paul Volcker.
Exactly. Yeah. Hey, Christine, I just want to talk a little bit about his legacy, from a markets perspective and from an investing perspective as well. Given what we know about the 1980s and what markets did and what inflation did after he raised rates so significantly, what's in store this time around?
Well, I mean, I think everybody is seeing that interest rates are going to go up. The you know, policymakers are making it very clear they're not going to back down on this. If they show any signs of, you know, weakness, I think people understand what will happen is kind of what happened to Paul Volcker's predecessor. So I think that is an example of where Powell sees he has to be steadfast. But as you would see reading the book, the chapters that follow the inflation fight are a series of financial crises that Paul Volcker's Fed had to deal with in the wake of the interest rate increases. And so, you know, when you hear these experts come on Bloomberg radio and television talking about something might break, I think, you know, what we saw back in the 80s was a lot of things broke. A lot of things a lot of risks were built up, everything from the Hunt brothers' speculation on silver to right. Continental Illinois savings and loans, all these different banks that went belly up. And so the ultimate one was the Latin American debt crisis. Mm. And that was so bad that in 82, I think that was really what caused Volcker to say, okay, we've got to back off and stop the inflation fight. So ultimately, it is often that something breaks that there's a financial crisis.
I think it's interesting on a day when the IMF has revised its estimates and the concern is about global central banks not doing enough. It fits right into your story and certainly your book. Christine, thank you so much. Christine Harper, check out her story in the new issue of Bloomberg Businessweek. And of course, our thanks to Jill Weber, the editor of the magazine. Christine is editor of Bloomberg Markets Magazine.
This is Bloomberg Businessweek with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Uber and Lyft tumbling today after the Biden administration issued that proposal for a federal rule that would change the way it approaches workers' employment status. It's a move that could upend the ride-hailing company's business models since, as you know, they rely on millions of gig workers.
I mean, it's pretty incredible to see right? The way that these shares, the companies, are moving. Worth repeating these numbers. Uber down more than 11%. We got Lyft down more than 12%
right
now.
They are decliners?
DoorDash is down as well. Lyft is my decliner.
Yeah.
That's what I chose. But DoorDash and Uber are down. down just the same. Yeah. Jackie DeVallos is technology reporter for Bloomberg News. She joins us on the phone from Washington, D.C. Jackie, why did this news catch investors so off guard?
You know, I think that it was a long time coming. Even companies themselves said they were expecting this proposal to come out from the administration's first day in power. And so I think investors are really starting to grapple with what a gig worker friendly administration will really mean in practice. And this proposal is kind of the first start of that. Even though it was on companies' radars, labor activists' radars, it doesn't substantially change the way companies operate in the immediate term, but just the risk that it poses for their business models is still very much lingering, which is why you're seeing shares fall so much today.
You know, it's so funny. I keep going back to this comment that David Einhorn of Greenlight said that, you know, we really don't know what anything is worth. And he was really putting that against, you know, investments against kind of the big macro stories that are out there. But you take it something like Lyft and Uber or anybody else who's part of this gig economy. What does it, a gig, right? You take a gig and you do other things. That's what it's all about. But you do have to think that if these workers are classified as regular workers with all the benefits that come along with it, that's increased cost for the company, and it's going to change how they are valued. It will have to.
It has to. And, you know, the argument that companies and labor activists have actually made is that, you know, the way we classify employees is rooted in a law that just doesn't account for the rise of digital work. These laws were made, you know, in a post-World War II era, not when, you know, you're ordering food and hailing a ride just from your phone. And so the landscape has totally changed. You're absolutely right, Carolyn, that everyone in some capacity has a connection to gig work, whether you're the one ordering or you're the one actually delivering something to someone's doorstep. So this rule, I think, is the first step in which the administration is really looking to broaden that definition. There's not a whole ton of guidance that we have on, you know, will companies eventually have to fully reclassify? But, you know, Uber has a little bit of experience in that, you know, they had to do something similar in London. A Supreme Court ruling basically said that their drivers were full-time employees and had to be given certain benefits and wage protections. The company didn't tumble, you know, it's still alive. And so what a lot of legal experts are saying now is that, you know, this is really going to be hashed out more so in the courts, where this rule is now going to be the interpretation and the basis which, you know, that labor law is then applied.
What I find so incredible about the Uber and Lyft story is they entered these markets as disruptors, and in many places, including New York City, just decimated the incumbents, the taxi industry. Now we're at a place, and I think anyone who's tried to take an Uber or Lyft from the airport recognizes this, where you're getting into one of these cars to get back from the airport. It's costing so much more than it ended up costing a yellow cab, if you were to take a yellow cab. But you can't get a yellow cab these days because, you know, those drivers aren't necessarily around.
Yeah.
Jackie, talk a little bit about the way the landscape has changed and what ends up happening here, because it does seem like at the end of the day, the way that companies are able to pay for this is through higher fares.
Absolutely. And that's exactly what, you know, the industry groups who don't want a change will tell you, that, you know, we should keep things the way they are, because then it means that consumers will bear the cost. And, you know, while that might be kind of the extreme version, it's certainly going to be, you know, part of the reality. When you think about, you know, the protections that and the benefits that any employee has, whether it's, you know, a sick day or workers' compensation, a lot of these drivers have to put themselves sometimes in harm's way without, you know, knowing that that's what they're signing up for. And that's kind of this this debate now. It's not going to be one or the other. It's going to be some kind of hybrid. And investors are kind of pricing that in, companies as well. I think Uber has kind of come out at the forefront of this now that they've had to contend with this in Europe, that, you know, they're open to what they call an independent contractor plus model. So
yeah,
we may not, you know, have you be full-time employees, but hey, we'll throw some benefits your way.
Yeah, this is like innovation disruption bumping up against kind of the established models. We'll see how it plays out. Jackie DeVallos, technology reporter at Bloomberg News.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
Hey, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Keep driving, stay in prison.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody. Just about under 10 minutes left in today's trading session. Another volatile day bouncing around. We're certainly off our highs and lows of the session. Those Bank of England governor comments, Mr. Bailey, that certainly has put some pressure on the trade today, and we saw market reaction. We've got a great guest actually in studio. It has been a long time since we've had him in studio here.
Can't believe this is the first time I've gotten to meet him in person in 2 years doing this. Doug Ramsey is Chief Investment Officer at the Luthold Group. He joins us right now in the Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studios. Doug, good to have you with us. Is this your first time back to the city since the pandemic?
I was here end of February 2020, just as things were starting to erupt.
Welcome back. It's good to
great
have
to
you.
Be back.
It's good to have
great
you back
vibe
with
in the
us.
City. Great vibe here in the Bloomberg building as well.
Not a great vibe in the markets.
No. Well, it depends on your perspective. I mean, opportunities are being created here for flexible managers.
Well, what does that mean? So, I agree, right? Like when everybody's running for the exits, that's when you find opportunities. Much smarter investors than me have said that. And, you know, you're saying it too. So are you saying that we're near a bottom when it comes to the equity dropout? Or no, but even the selling so far provides some great opportunities.
No, I think there's a ways to go. But I mean, the valuations are far better than they were coming into this year. That's especially true for mid and small company stocks. You know, we track valuations across the landscape and globally, but mid caps and small caps are now somewhat below their long-term valuation averages, and we haven't been able to say that for quite a while. So that's encouraging. So I think there's a buying opportunity that is developing. It's not yet there. I mean, if we are going to get one in valuation terms on large caps, we've still got some distance to go. And that's normally the way things unfold in a bear market. Is large caps have better liquidity. They tend to be more defensive in nature.
Right.
They are really the last to fall in a cyclical bear market. And I still think we have that phase ahead of us. But I am encouraged by some of the valuations I see in pockets of the market for a later buying opportunity.
What about when it comes to the large caps? When do you think we'll get to a buying opportunity for those?
I don't like to get too focused in really either on time horizon or price levels. I mean, I do think what's going to evolve over the next several months is we'll have the best buying opportunity we've had in the stock market for over a decade. Mm. I mean, not back to 2009 levels, but I think it will be a very good buying opportunity. But just in terms of numbers, and again, I mean, it's well known that valuations are not a timing tool.
Right.
But just for some perspective, if we were to put in a bear market low that matched the valuations we saw in March of 2020,
right,
which was by far the most expensive bear market low in terms of valuations, we'd still have to sink to 2,900 in the S&P 500. And again, I don't want to get too locked into price levels here because
right now PE on the S&P 500 is about 17 or about 17.5. So still high-ish?
Well, we look at, we certainly look at forward PEs, but okay. The 2900 was really referring to like the average of multiple different valuation statistics. And we do something akin to what Robert Shiller does with the 10-year PE. We've been doing it for decades using 5-year normalized earnings.
Okay.
I'm just adjusting for the fact that earnings dramatically can overshoot as they did in 2021, and then they get crushed during recessions. Let's just try to see through that by smoothing out earnings for the cyclicality of that earnings can have. So on that basis, yeah, we'd have to drop our multiple on the basis of normalized earnings is still around 23.
That's a pretty big drop from here.
Yeah, you'd have to go from 23 to 18 to match, again, what will be the highest valuation we've ever seen. And then we supplement that with work on, the price to sales ratio, price to cash flow.
Is there anything different about this market environment other than we're coming out of a pandemic that none of us have lived through before? Like, is there something, the old adage, it's different this time around, yeah, or it's not different this time around. Is there something different about this market environment, though?
Well, the abrupt change in not just monetary policy, but also in fiscal. Just the delta versus a year ago. We blew out the trailing 12-month federal deficit to as high as 18% of GDP. Now it's about 4%. And, we all talk about QT and the rate hikes, but the degree of swing in fiscal stimulus has been every bit as great.
So, Doug, in terms of the way we're thinking about this moving forward and the Federal Reserve's role here, how are you looking at the terminal rate? How are you thinking about what the Fed is doing when it comes to tightening in the context of the investment decisions that you're making?
We don't necessarily have a forecast, for where that funds rate might peak. We are assuming they've already overdone it.
Huh.
And it's the emphasis. They are data dependent. The question is, are they the right data points? They are coincident to lagging data points. Our work would say that inflation has probably peaked out. The leading inflation indicators.
Is this why you say Powell doesn't need to be Volcker?
There are a number of reasons. Well, along those lines,
this fits in with a discussion we just had.
I'm trying to take some good notes here about what Doug is talking
He's
about.
Killing me.
Well, why this is some good stuff, Carol. That's what they say in the biz. This is some good stuff.
Even though we're cautious on the stock market and the economy, we do think that inflation's peaked and is going to come down significantly. One reason is the stock market itself. It's the negative wealth effect, and Bill Dudley in the spring came very close to mentioning that term exactly. It's the fact that, we've had a 25% stock market decline. The issue is, don't think about it just in terms of the percentage decline in the index. Think about how large the stock market was in relation to GDP at its peak coming into this year. It was more than 200% of GDP. So this relatively moderate decline is a big deal in terms of the wealth destruction.
We never have enough time with you, and I hope you got your notes there, Tim. 20 seconds. So what to you will say we're near bottom? I know you don't really necessarily have a number, but what kind of feel do we have? You have to be quick.
Lower valuations, a big relative crack in the blue chips, where small caps and mid caps, they probably still go to new lows, but maybe show some relative strength. So giving and maybe a give up, and then we've seen it in the utilities.
Yeah.
But when you start to see the defensives crack, that's a sign that people are selling what they can, and we may be near a complete capitulation, which I think is still ahead.
Did you get your notes?
Oh, you'll hear in a couple minutes what I have to say.
Yeah, we love talking with you. So come back anytime, on phone, in person's even better, but safe trips back. Doug Ramsey, Chief Investment Officer at the Luthold Group.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.